and awesome folks all around, which is true. They're just like an amazing family. They really are. They have almost every gaming product you can imagine, from retro N64s to Nintendo DSs to the PS4 and the Switch. They've got it all. They have a large variety of video games for all platforms and a large collection of collectibles, including action figures and Funko Pops. And the kids get discounts with every A on the report card. Check them out on their Facebook page. Follow them on Twitter, @TheGameIn, @TheGameIn. And that's in with two N's, @TheGameIn. Got a question about a game? You looking for something hard to get? Message them on Facebook. Drop them an email at TheGameInPA@gmail.com, or give them a call at 267-424-2535. Visit them on their website, TheGameIn.com. Please do check them out. If you have gamers in your family, if you have gamers that are friends, you're looking for gifts to give, this is a great place. And I'll tell you, they will work with you. They will make sure that you get what you need. They are a phenomenal group of folks. And again, this has been a very, very hard time for family-owned businesses. Here we are amid COVID and the shutdown and all this. They have been kind of flexible. They have been, they've done everything they can to kind of reach out and kind of maintain their store in the community, support their amazing family. Again, and in Black History Month right now, what a better time to kind of support Black-owned businesses. Go to the Game Inn from Quakertown, PA. Check them on the Facebook page. All the links will be in the show notes today. I want to give that special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. Just check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter at @SongADayMan. That's @SongADayMan with two N's. That's last name, Man. @SongADayMan on Twitter. Thank you so much. Today's show, like I said, we're doing things a little bit different today. Normally, I have a guest or I have something planned ahead of time, but I kept on coming back to this feeling that, I would like this Monday night show, right, at least kind of maybe once a month or so, perhaps even more. I would love if that kind of turned into something even more. We got more folks calling in and stuff like that, maybe even a separate spinoff show with this, because I think that we need these spaces where we can kind of come together as a progressive community and just to kind of say what's on our mind. And frankly, like, this community has been like the reason for being for Raging Chicken. I mean, this community has been so supportive of the work that we've been doing since we got started in 2011. I want to be able to turn more and more to folks to say, hey, what would you like to see on the show? Who should we have on the show? I'm going to be sending out into our mailing list. I'm going to post a special, probably I'll do it on a Facebook Live thing, so I'm playing around a little bit with that too. Send out a little poll to everybody who kind of joins the show to say, hey, you got some suggestions on people we should have on the show? You got some ideas? Got some issues that you want to be covered and so on? I'd love to hear from you. So having said that, that's what we're going to do is, we'll take your calls. Anybody want to call in? If you're joining on our YouTube page right now, you can also join us live on the Podbean app, and you can call in directly there. Or, hey, how you doing, Wheezy? Thanks for joining on our YouTube page. If you got some comments, you got some questions, you got anything you want to kind of talk about, you can lay it right there in the comment section too as well. Be happy to address it there as well. I've got some, I had some preloads, some people who couldn't make the show tonight that kind of sent me some questions, some ideas that they had floating around, so we could talk about those too as well. But if you want to call in, like I said, all you got to do is hit that little call button at the bottom of your screen. You call in, I'll gladly take your call, talk whatever you want, even if it's just the freaking crazy ice storm that's out there. So please do. While you're over there on our YouTube page too as well, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you hit that bell so you'll know every time we go live. We've been doing more live show. We've been kind of slowly increasing our content on YouTube too as well. I know like our numbers aren't rocking the charts at this point. We've got 78 subscribers, but if we could break 80 over the next couple days, that would be awesome, right? Just that little couple additional subscribers, let me know that people are out there, kind of like the content that we're doing, that'd be fantastic. So like I said, anybody want to jump in, please jump in. I'll go right to the comments. So I got this this comment from people are on Twitter, you probably know this, you know who I'm talking about. This is from the divisive Third Summers brother, aka @HugeTinyMistake from Twitter. I love just reading the handles. That's the best thing. Let me just go to this question that he sent in, and I thought it was kind of interesting. So Dave Weigel had posted a piece in here, and this is what Dave Weigel had said on Twitter. It said, Pelosi was going to do this 1-6 commission either way, but Republicans moving so fast from we need to heal to time to investigate the Democrats sure makes it easier politically, right? And Dave Weigel, basically, and he's a writer for Washington Post, political reporter for Washington Post, puts up these headlines. Senator Graham says Kamala Harris could be impeached if GOP takes over the House, right? And then another, that was from, where was that posted? That was, I'm not sure where the headline was from, but then from Fox News. House Republicans demand answers from Pelosi on security decisions leading up to the Capitol riot. So I tend to agree with Weigel there. This makes it a lot easier for Democrats who still can't quite shake the, you know, their fear of their own shadow kind of thing to act with power. So that's, you know, definitely something that I agree with. But here's the question. So we'd love to hear your thoughts on this and what it means to only have one political party interested in democracy and the difficulty that that presents to said party. That's a great question. And I actually had a show a couple weeks ago, a few weeks ago now. It's on a, you know, I spent a whole lot of time reading to the microphone, which is, you know, it's a weird feeling, to be honest with you. But it's about a piece that I wrote a few years back that was about what actually happened after the Tea Party victories, right? And after the Democrats, and I would argue Obama too as well, squandered the early part of the presidency, of his presidency, and the kind of supermajorities that they had because they wanted to, you know, have Democrats come on and then play nice and all that fun stuff. They, you know, they could have passed like a rapid fire, a whole series of measures, whatever. But, you know, we know that story. This is old news. But in that piece that I was writing, I was talking about this, the aftermath of the Wisconsin uprising, right, in the wake of Governor Scott Walker's assault on kind of unions, working families, healthcare workers, public education across the board. They occupied the, you know, Wisconsin state building, state capitol for, what, 3 weeks or something like this, nonviolently, we have to say, right? There's the distinction. And then there was, you know, Occupy Wall Street was coming shortly on its heels, like whatever, 6 months later. There were some other occupations in state capitol buildings in Ohio, and it's all kind of demanding the rights of democracy because it was pretty clear that there were, you know, people that, you know, didn't give half a crap about, you know, respectability or hearing the other side or so on. They were about the pursuit of power. And there were a series of writers and Democratic Party leadership, right, at the national level, right, at the state level to some degree, too, as well, were kind of saying, they're calling for, you know, let's all calm down. Let's all kind of like, you know, get back together. Let's be reasonable with each other. Let's kind of, you know, this is not the way we should do things. And they were calling for an appeal to civility. And that is a dangerous, dangerous pathway. When you only have one party that agrees to the terms of civility, right? And the person that kept on getting cited in these kind of, you know, supposedly heady conversations, heady constitutional conversations, was like James Madison. James Madison worried about factions, and he was concerned about factional violence and all this. So we all need civility. But the problem was, is that what all those people, in my view, what they failed to recognize was that Madison and the kind of even the framers of the Constitution, they were establishing this idea of civility and protection against factions in a context that was like post-constitutional. Like, in other words, after everybody had agreed to the, you know, to the rules of the game, this is how would we proceed, right? That was kind of the idea, right? And you could imagine that's true, right? I mean, so instead of resorting to, I mean, the whole promise of democracy was to be able to solve problems without having to resort to violence, right? It was, you know, it was laying down the guns and resorting to argumentation, right? Resorting to, you know, coalition building. And again, politics can be messy and it can be mean and it can be tough and cruel and hard. I mean, that's all true. Right. But it's better than, you know, let's all kind of line up on the battlefields and whoever's left standing at the end of the at the end of the battle gets to rule. Right. And that was the whole promise. And so the Constitution, like when the framers were kind of discussing these things, and everybody holds up Madison as kind of, you know, saying that, you know, we should need the civility and everything. But they were trying to kind of envision this, you know, making arguments for this Constitution so that this civility could reign, right? The arguments would have to reign. The problem was, is that the problem with invoking Madison in the context of the Tea Party, in the context of an emerging more radicalized, more racist, more white nationalist, more white supremacist, more like, you know, misogynist Republican Party. The problem with that is that you saw an emerging faction that could care less about civility. They didn't care about the rules of the game. They were about subverting the rules of the game, right? And what had happened in, again, this is my reading on things, but what had happened in the aftermath of the explosion of the Tea Party and this radical right-wing kind of legislative agenda and kind of social agenda and, you know, this billionaire-funded dark money program of, you know, kind of like destroying labor, organized labor, stripping women of their rights, the kind of protections and rights and control over their own bodies, stripping away kind of everything that was the public, right? As Rick Smith had always said, you know, they want to repeal the 20th century, which is so apt. So the problem was, and what I argued in that piece was that, you know, showing up, doing this is like showing up to like a gunfight with thank you cards, right? Right. The idea that like, oh, you've got these radical extremists and these violent extremists. So, oh, what we just need to do is be nice to them. And then, as Obama famously said, the fever will break and they'll come back over into the fold. And this has been the real concern with Joe Biden, right? I mean, that he wants to kind of work bipartisan. He wants to kind of work together with the other side and we can kind of come together. We need unity. But, you know, he's been, I don't know, so far so good. I mean, there's been some things I can pick on and things like this. But, you know, he's had a lot more spine than I thought, which I think is helping bolster the rest of the Democrats. So having said that, the, you know, Saul Alinsky years ago, right, when he wrote A Rules for Radicals, he famously began that book by talking about how the left or progressives or however you want to call it at the time, or freedom, what he called like liberals or whatever, people interested in social justice, however you want to say, they've become skittish around the word power. Right, that when you started talking about exercising power or gaining power or establishing power, that people would get freaked out. Right, people on the left, liberals in particular, would get freaked out because they felt that was a dirty word. Right, and it was true. Right, and if you think about, I can remember growing up with that sense. Right, you know, you're hearing it over and over again: power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Right. Put aside the fact that was not the entire quote, put aside that that was not the kind of the full intention of how it's been used. But the whole idea about exercising power is somehow dirty. And so we should somehow come to this place of civility where we could rise above conflict and kind of, you know, in some high-minded fashion, grapple with, you know, the interest of everybody. And for the longest time, we heard this discussed, especially in terms of the Senate. Right, where we can put aside these earthly kind of ideas and concerns and interest and kind of do things in the interest of the broad, you know, the broad public. Hey, Nick, Nicholas, hey, glad to see you come up. I gave you guys a shout out, the game in, right? Join us on YouTube right now. Fantastic. Like I'll say once again, there's a guy, if you're over on YouTube, you're looking for something right now, you want to get his attention, you're looking for a game, ask him a question right now in the chat. I certainly don't mind. Good to see you here. But so anyways, the whole idea there was you can't, you know, the Senate's purpose was to, you know, temper things down and to kind of appeal to kind of broader reason. what we saw, you know, I would argue it has a much longer trajectory than this, but we can say at least in the Tea Party, the Tea Party victories in the 2010 midterm elections, and then what happened following that. That's when we started getting, you know, the real kind of overt racism against Barack Obama would come out. People would show up with AR-15s, to in order to kind of tell people that they don't deserve healthcare, right? I mean, literally, no. You want to give people health care? You know, time to water the tree of liberty with blood. You know, I mean, like, you got to be kidding me. But that's really where we were, right? That's really where we were. And when you're in that, when one side has basically given up, right, the any commitment to the rules and is about pure power, you know, thank you cards are not going to work. So what Saul Alinsky was saying, to get back to that point, what Saul Alinsky was saying in Rules for Radicals was that power is not a dirty word. That matter of fact, that is what politics is about. It's about working people. It's about the mass of all of us, right? It's about the people exercising their power, not the elites, right? And it's about feeling confident in our own power, in our own power to organize, right? And to exercise that power and make demands. That is what we want. And by disciplining poor folks, working folks, you know, people on the margins of society, right? Right now we're talking about the vast majority of us, right? Because we're all hitting the squeeze. But especially with those folks who are being kind of most negatively impacted by a society, by a culture, by a city, by a government, by a corporation, to tell them that power is a dirty word is to basically try to convince them and give them a message that they should just shut up and be complicit with their own oppression. And Alinsky rejected that. And he said, we need to talk overtly about power. And let's be clear. One of the reasons why that liberals in particular had felt so skittish around power is because they had been reacting to the McCarthy era in the 50s, right? Because you know what? Socialists and communists, right? And radicals of all sort were talking about power. The Black Power movement had power in its name, right? Right? They were about the exercise of power to achieve equality, to expand and deepen democracy, right? To say that we deserve a bigger piece of the pie. And when we look right now at a time when we see such an incredible inequality, right? When we see like Jeff Bezos, he's such an easy one to pick on, but you know, Elon Musk, take your billionaire pick. We see the inequalities that is all over the place as people are suffering, right? And then you tell us that we should not exercise power, but we should just be nice. And we should encourage our oppressors to kind of like see that we're real people and please hand me some crumbs. It's just not going to work out. So in that, now to go back to the piece that I was saying, how I started this, in that piece, you know, I talked about, you know, Madison was not the person to really look to. If we have to play the founding fathers game, it's not Madison, it's Thomas Paine, right? It's Thomas Paine because Thomas Paine was in a revolutionary situation where there was a power imbalance, where the people were being oppressed and had no representation. There's my hat tonight, right? I don't know if you can see it online, but this is from DC, right? No taxation, or taxation without representation, right? DC statehood. It's the same thing, right? That was the, you know, the core principle. And again, it was more complicated than that. Absolutely. But the idea, what Paine, like our most radical founding father, right, who basically pissed off all the landed elite then back then too as well, was basically writing, you know, to the Quakers, who were kind of, you know, trying to discipline the revolutionaries for their desire to take up arms against England, right? And let me be clear, I'm not arguing that we take up arms, right? The other side's doing that. This is not the point. That was a revolutionary situation we have, different than we have right now. But what they did is they were organizing, and the Quakers were basically saying, no, you need to work with the king. you know, you need to, we need peace always. And Thomas Paine was like, look, we want peace too. But the fact is that they're killing our families. They're destroying our economies. They're taking our homes. They're wrecking our livelihoods. And so in order to get to that peace, right, we are willing to bear the burdens of our day, right? We are willing to take on and get our hands dirty and not operate in some sort of perfect sphere in order to achieve that peace, right? And so the point I was making in that piece is very, I think, very much very similar to where we are now. The Republican Party has abandoned any hope to be an equal participant in democracy. As much as Nancy Pelosi, you know, as much as Nancy Pelosi says we need a strong Republican Party, I'm like, no, no, no. We need to put the Republican Party to bed. Right? There is no encouragement at this point. We just saw an impeachment hearing in which the Republican Party supported Donald Trump, refused to convict him for sedition, for inciting violence in the Capitol, for the murder of people, of police officers, which they claim to love so much. Right? So I don't know. I mean, I look at it at this point, you know, through that lens of what we saw with Bernie Sanders, like what Bernie Sanders is like, there's a meme going on around right now. I got to watch my mouth. My daughter's down here right now, but there's a meme that's going on with Bernie Sanders when he's like, first off, F all of you, right? That's kind of like the cartoon of it. And meaning like, no, look, you're not an equal player anymore. And by Dave Weigel going, kind of posting those pieces, they're showing that already Lindsey Graham is saying, oh, we're going to have to impeach Kamala Harris. For what? It doesn't matter to them. Truth doesn't matter to them. Facts doesn't matter to them. They have helped create and cultivate the QAnon conspiracy, which basically is telling everybody that it's time to go kill Democrats and some Republicans too. Those people are gone. Let's leave them to the psychologists. Let's leave them to the therapists. Let's leave them here. That is, they are gone from our political world. And right here in Pennsylvania, Doug Mastriano, you got to be kidding me. Scott Perry, you got to be kidding me. Daryl Metcalf?
Daryl Metcalf.
Daryl's like the incompetent one of the bunch, right? He's like the clown of the bunch. Come on, Scott, wait up for me, right? No less dangerous and horrible human being, but whatever. Daryl's out there. But we've got him right here in Pennsylvania. There's, you know, when I first heard that, you know, after the election, that there was a group of Democrats, they wanted to get together, and some Republicans want to have the civility caucus. Let's all get along and kind of like, you know, rise above it all and be kind to one another. You cannot be kind to these people until the Republican Party, as it is put to bed. That's what I think. And, you know, what, you know, huge, tiny mistake, which I love, once again, was kind of suggesting there, right? It can make it hard for the difficulty it presents to the one party that seems to be interested in democracy. And I do believe the Democratic Party remains the only party that is in existence right now that has a commitment to democracy. But I don't think it presents a difficulty, right? It should be a clarifying moment, right? This should be all the clarity that you need, that the Republican Party is going to feed you lines of bullshit. And if you take that on its face value and believe it, it's on you. Because they have proven themselves over and over again, and they're ramping up to do it again. So for me, this is not difficult. It means that now it means you have to act, you have to go big, you have to prioritize voting rights, you have to prioritize those democratic institutions. You have to sink the filibuster once and for all. I'm telling you, the more I've been doing a lot of like background, listening to a lot of podcasts and interviews. I'm forgetting the dude's name. He wrote this book called The Kill Switch. It's on the filibuster. No, the filibuster is not a tool of like civility and the way things are done. The filibuster comes from the desire to maintain slavery and racial segregation. That's where it came from. James Calhoun, look it up. Go check out the kill switch. Search up that dude's name. I'll get him before the end of the show. Search up that guy. You find out where that comes from. So for these folks, these senators who basically are coming out and saying, well, you know, this is the way that the Senate operates. That's a load of garbage. You're protecting a racist legacy that basically prolonged like the kind of systemic white nationalist violence by almost a century. That's the filibuster. And, you know, I was listening to, I can't remember which podcast I was listening to, but, you know, in this interview, I hate when I get really vague like this. I'm sorry. My bad. But the person was being interviewed. I'm going to have to look up this guy's name. The person was being interviewed basically said, look, Joe Biden and the whole class of Democrats are in leadership right now, which, you know, again, baby boomers, you've had your time. Go retire, please, now. Right? Even Bernie, as much as I love you, Bernie, okay, man, let's start, you know, you're at a point where you can start passing that torch, right? I love Bernie, though. That's whatever. But still, they came kind of like to power, right, in the Senate and the House and all this. They got into politics at a time that was post-World War II, right, and was at, you know, because of World War II in part, because of the large number of workplaces that were unionized, right? Because of a more flattened inequality, right? You didn't have the great disparities that you had during the Great Depression. Because all those things were operating, the filibuster at that time was one of these kind of like gentlemen's, and I do mean gentlemen's, like a gentleman's tool, right? To make sure that every voice is heard. And I do believe legitimately that a lot of those folks, that's what they believed. They actually thought, you know, the filibuster was a good institution. You want to make sure that you're all coming together and all that. But what this person was saying is that is an anomaly in our history. That does not represent the majority of our time here. Right? And it certainly doesn't. There's my dog. It certainly does not accurately represent what the filibuster did and where it came from. So. That. So I don't know if that actually kind of answers the question or kind of gives my thoughts, but that's where it took me, man. Oh, God. God. Oh, boy. It's a good one tonight. So I hope everybody out there is weathering these storms okay. I think just right before I went live tonight is when we started getting some freezing rain. Let me pull up this other thing. Been reading a bunch of stuff lately too, and now this, you got me off on this filibuster thing. Maybe I'll share a bit of this. Yeah, maybe I will. Well, just a reminder, if you were there, if you're kind of watching us on YouTube, want to make sure that you hit that subscribe button, make sure you hit that bell, and make sure that, you know, every time that we go live, you're getting notifications so you can kind of help join the discussion. Also remind everybody out there that you can help support this show by becoming a member of Raging Chicken for as little as $5 a month. Just go to patreon.com/RCPress today. Hey, we just got some folks from Lehigh Valley DSA is one meeting away from kicking Robert's rules to the curb in favor of Rusty's rules. Let's hear it. That's actually, well, thanks for the comments there. We've got Lehigh Demcon. Fantastic. Glad to hear it. How's that happening? And who's that one meeting away? What's going to be put in its place? I'd love to hear that. Or more about Rusty's rules, I guess, right? I assume that's not arm wrestling. Just kidding. Yeah, so, and you know, listen, if anybody's out there is kind of listening on the Podbean app, you can go right down to the bottom. You got to hit that little gift icon. You can drop us a little, you know, a little item in our tip jar. You give us one, you know, you got some golden beans. Could be $1, $5 or more. Anything you can kind of contribute would help support this podcast. So, kind of while we're looking, is if there's anybody, and reminder once again, you know, keep the comments coming on YouTube. If anybody wants to call in here on the Podbean app, feel free to call in. I'd love to hear what people got to say, what's on your mind. I was just reading earlier on today. I've been a huge fan of the American Prospect lately, since David Dayan has taken over as one of the kind of, was he an executive editor, I guess? Let me see if I got this right. His title right? Something like that. A managing editor, executive editor, whatever it might be. I think it's executive editor. And the latest episode, which is, you know, perfect. It's right up the alley we have here now. It says Democrats and the Government Together Again. That's the kind of subtitle of this this edition. We've got stuff on organizing the party, the incoming House progressives. We've got some good stuff in here. But David Dayan's piece, and I'll just read you a bit from beginning of David Dayan's piece on this, because it reflects a lot of things that have been going through my mind the last few days. And mind you, this was published before the impeachment hearing, so it was kind of leading up to that. The IDEMCOM says, the IWW tends to use Rusty's rules. It's simpler. Yeah, I mean, believe me. Robert's rules is in my experience, you know, again, well-intentioned, but there's so many ins and outs of it that it actually, more often than not, gets used to squash debate than others. Remind me to tell you at some point, you know, I don't know, probably not tonight, but maybe another, well, who knows, maybe tonight. That was the first, when we started taking over our local union years ago, that's one of the ways that our statewide union basically squashed us, was through Robert's Rules. So we forced ourselves to learn the ins and outs of Robert's Rules so that they can never do that to us again. But yes. So here's David Dayan. This is from his piece, The Prospect, from, it's called Quelling Our National Riot. It starts off, invoking the Nazi era in a political debate is typically dismissed as a bad faith tactic for those without a compelling argument. But many of us, including many who grew up Jewish, could not ignore the rhyming of history after rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. When photos emerged of vandals in shirts that read Camp Auschwitz, or 6MWWE, which stands for 6 million weren't enough, that feeling deepened. It's easy to point to the haplessness of the Capitol riot and laugh at how short it fell of a real fascist coup. But the beer hall putsch, an early Nazi uprising, never even got past a police cordon blocking one of Munich's main squares. The threat was neutralized and Hitler and his conspirators were apprehended. It wasn't until a decade later, when Nazis were elevated to power, that it became clear that the putsch, I can always get that word, was the beginning rather than an ending. Revolutions, coups, and insurrections often fail before they succeed. The well-documented events of January 6th have enabled us to learn a lot about the rioters quickly. There were the led and the misled. Their anger stoked by social media and encouraged by a mountain of lies, from election fraud to a secret society of elite pedophiles. There were those I've seen described as chaos tourists, marching with their cell phones in front of them, quote, doing it for the gram, for the refracted glory of being watched. They were off-duty policemen and Air Force veterans, personifying the links between cops and the military figures and the far right. There were state lawmakers and corporate CEOs and dilettantes flying in on private jets. And there were very clearly organized and determined nationalists and racists, extremist leaders and militia members sporting zip ties and weapons, explicitly seeking to do more than scare the political class. Hold on a second. Sorry about that. Just quieting the ring. Puffed up with decades of hate, these disparate figures lashed out with violence against the state, justifying it as the only way to save America. It was bloody and could have been much bloodier. But more chilling was how excellent, like exultant, I can never say that word either, the display was. People were acting out fantasies harbored in the deepest reaches of their imaginations, typed out on Parler or spoken on a podcast and then made real. They reveled in it. And just by taking action, open up possibilities for more cruelties in the future. A taste of power doesn't lead to abstinence. Right? 100%. I agree. Right? There's a... I think what David Dayan is pointing to here, too, as well, and again, this is an open question. I think that we need to make sure that we see this as an open question, especially in light of, you know, the unwillingness of Republicans in the Senate to convict Trump. You've just basically emboldened those folks. You said, see, you can get away with it. You can get away with it. A little bit further on in the article, he says, people are searching for links establishing coordination between the White House and the rioters. But what happened during 4 years in public view tells enough of the story. Well before the election chaos, Trump projected a false picture of American catastrophe without him at the helm. He gave recognition to those with racist, anti-Semitic, misogynistic, xenophobic views. He created the space for them to emerge from the shadows. He told them his loss would signal the nation's end. Trump activated a long simmering undercurrent of discontent and disunity, sending into battle those who would take America by force rather than submit to its multiculturalism and tolerance. He broadened and deepened a movement for hate, and once activated, that movement cannot be easily deactivated. Right? It's a bit sobering, right? It is for me, at least. You know, I don't know about you, but I found out, you know, if you've been listening to the podcast at all, you know that Sean and I have both been talking about this on Fridays, how there's a certain degree of relief that both of us have been feeling. And I know a lot of people that I've talked to are feeling like after, you know, the inauguration, like after we actually feel Trump is gone. And that relief and that release of the pent up assault, like the, you know, the I should say not the pent up assault, but the pent up emotional and physical result of the assault of the last 4 years, is really palpable. I felt it. I mean, when I surprised myself, and I've said this before, and I'll say it again, is when Joe Biden got inaugurated, when I took the oath of office, I'm watching her, and suddenly I got tears rolling down my face. I'm like, what the hell is this? Right. You know, I'm like, you know, no supporter of Joe Biden's. That was my point. Right. It wasn't. And, you know, realized pretty quickly that it had nothing to do with like, yay for Biden. I feel so good for Biden. It felt with like, oh, my God, it's actually over, you know. And what Dan reminds us here, and I think it's well said, is that it's actually not over. Right. And to assume that it's over is dangerous. And then we have to kind of, it doesn't mean that we have to go back to a state of panic, right? But it does mean that we have to be absolutely vigilant. Yeah, I agree. I absolutely felt like I could breathe better too as well. There's no doubt about it. I felt like I could see better even. I mean, I kept on saying to people that, you know, I feel like I've kind of got like this cloud kind of stuffed in my brain, right? That like my eyes are just a little bit hazy, and I felt like, oh God, that was gone. Welcome, Shireen. Just dropped into the store, to the store, just dropped into the podcast. That's good. Remind everybody too, if any additional comments you want me to address, you got stuff you want to throw out there, whether it's in on YouTube or if you want to call in here in the podcast, I'd love to hear from you. You've also got the comments down below. It's fantastic. So that's David. I would strongly recommend checking out that piece by David Dayan. That's in the latest edition of the American Prospect, the January, February edition. I just got mine in the mail like a few days ago. Yes, I actually subscribed to the physical copy of it. I do believe. You know, I sit there and I'm always kind of like, hey, you can help support Raging Chicken by becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/RCPress for those $5 a month. You become a blah, 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 right? But I do believe in supporting, you know, progressive media. I mean, I have multiple publications that I subscribe to. I donate to, you know, I'm a member of many different podcasts because, like, I believe, you know, if you really want to sustain kind of progressive left media, that we, you know, there's no one that is going to do it but ourselves, as they say. Right. Shana says, I feel better most days until people in the Inky start offering hot takes on central PA organizing. You know, I have to admit, I saw that circulating around. I only read like the first couple paragraphs of it, because when I first saw it, I didn't read the entire thing, but I saw people commenting on this. And particularly targeting Central PA. If you got the link, you can throw that down in the in the chat. That'd be awesome. I'd be happy to take that up and talk about it, because I've been looking for an excuse to spend some time with it too as well. So that's good. But yeah, it's very interesting when you get people just wanting to criticize and stuff. I'd also be really interested in hearing people's takes on the way that the whole impeachment trial ended, because I'm of multiple minds about it. I think all this I'll tell you where I'm at, and you can totally tell me that I'm full of it, right? But this is one of those times when don't think the Democrats just screwed it up. Like, I keep on hearing people say that they should have had more witnesses, they should have brought the witnesses in. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that that wasn't the right call. Now, I say I'm really of two minds of this, because part of me believes that, or the other side of the mind is actually also saying, well, look, there people need to be held accountable, right? People need to be held accountable. And the impeachment was the way to do it. But I'm like, look, the Republican Party just showed themselves. They showed everybody who they are. Right. And realistically speaking, I don't know if there's anybody who actually believed that those Republicans were going to vote to kind of impeach and convict Trump. And I'm with Jamie Raskin on this one. I don't believe there's anything that could have been said that would have convinced more people to come over. They needed like 10 more Republicans. I don't think that was in the cards. And if you want to talk like brass tacks of things, right? But instead of allowing them to make, just like he said, instead of them making an absolute kind of crazy show of things, right, with all their nonsense and conspiracy theories and all that nonsense, okay, we'll put this to bed. We're going to claim victory, and now we're going to go after them through criminal prosecutions. I think that's what should happen. But, the kind of going after those folks for not having witnesses, and by trying to kind of create this sense that, no, it was like the Biden kind of squashed it because he wants everybody to get along. Maybe that'll turn out to be true. There's a piece that came out in The Intercept that I think Ryan Grimm put out. I have not read that yet, but that's something that, Ryan Grimm's pretty kind of well-sourced on this stuff, and he tends to be a careful thinker about the insider stuff. So I'm curious what his take is on this, and I might be wrong, right? My take might be naive or otherwise, but we shall see. I'm not convinced, like some of the folks on the left are, that the Democrats just screwed up again. I understand that as a compelling narrative, because look, the Democratic leadership has proven itself time and time again over the past couple decades to be spineless and to run away from a fight. I don't see that happening to the same degree as before. Right. And it seemed to me that Jeremy Raskin in particular was freaking pissed off and represented that. So we shall see. Okay, let me see if I can pull up this link. That'd be a good thing to talk about, because I have been wanting to read this all day and I keep on getting interrupted. Like, getting kids from the school. Although we didn't have school today, but I just had a ton of work I had to do. I had to work, so okay, let me read a little bit of this. Feel free to drop stuff down in the comments anytime you want to flag it as well, a piece that's particularly outrageous. I'm going to throw this in the in our YouTube channel too as well, so if you want to follow along, this is the article that we were talking about. So here it is. Pennsylvania Democrats got their most important job done in 2020. On just about everything else, they flopped big time. Joe Biden won the critical battleground state, but the incumbent Democratic treasurer defeated. The open seat for the state auditor general, no dice. Flipping either of the GOP-held congressional districts Democrats targeted, nope. Taking over the state house, not even close. So now Democrats are searching for the path forward as redistricting looms this year before high-profile races for governor in the U.S. Senate in 2022. Even as the Republican Party faces down its own messy identity crisis, the 2020 election has left some Pennsylvania Democrats in deep introspection. Right? I love sentences like that, by the way. has left some Pennsylvania Democrats in deep introspection, because that points you to the source of the story, right? Where they can hide behind something, right? So it's not surprising to me why we lost. We underestimated Donald Trump's power and control, which we seem to do over and over again, said Jamie Parapato, executive director of the grassroots Democratic group Turn PA Blue, which organized in state legislative races. Now people realize we still have a lot of battles ahead of us, she added. We're not really sure how to fix them. Biden's Pennsylvania win was largely fueled by big support in the suburbs of Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, and other cities, as well as gains outside his native Scranton and the huge margins of Philadelphia that Democrats need to win statewide. But the party's down-ballot losses in the same suburbs that drove Biden's victory suggest his coalition might not be a reliably Democratic one. Meanwhile, the party's grassroots is increasingly defined as an ascendant left focused on issues like systemic racism, income inequality, and climate change. You know, those policies that get 75% to 80% approval rating among the American public. Those things. Oh, I'm sorry. That's not what was written here. I just want to make sure people got that as a subtext. So that wing has long been wary of what activists see as Democrats' myopic focus on white suburban swing voters, often at the expense of black and brown people in urban areas. But there's internal tension over the party's response to violence that followed last year's racial justice protest. Oh, you got to be kidding me. Which some centrist Democrats believe fueled the belief that liberals are indifferent to public safety. Oh, so this is the nonsense that they're going down. I get it. And some Democrats continue to emphasize the need to connect with white voters in rural and post-industrial areas who voted for Trump. A great benefit for us in the past 4 years for unifying Democrats was Donald Trump, says Gratz Washeni, a Democratic chair of Monroe County in the Poconos region. He's the best recruiter we've ever had. So now, without that boogeyman in the room, the burden is on us to perform. Enter John Fetterman, the progressive lieutenant governor who launched his campaign for U.S. Senate last week. Fetterman wants to legalize marijuana. He waves a pot flag outside his office in Harrisburg and supports Medicare for All, the signature program backed by Bernie Sanders. He's centering his campaign around the labor union way of life, a message he's betting will resonate with rural white voters and working class of black Philadelphians alike. I've been warning Democrats that while Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are critical, the small counties are also important, Fetterman said. It's never urban versus rural. See if I can pull out what's down here. Some Democrats say that Fetterman is too liberal to win a competitive general election and that the lesson from last year and the 2018 midterm elections is that the path to victory runs through the state's populous suburbs where moderate left of center candidates are the broad. Look, this is rehashing a Democratic Party narrative, a mainstream conservative corporate Democratic narrative about how we win. Shana says Mark Price had a good thread on this in Twitter about this. We ran a centrist for Congress out here, but he still lost. I like the candidate we ran, but the center standing for nothing doesn't win. Absolutely, that's the idea, right? I will say this: I am fully aware that there are places where a centrist Democrat may be more appealing and may win, right? But the problem is those tend to be places that have a lot of money, right? That employ a lot of consultants, right? That take their leads from a national party, right? And the same people who for years have not put resources in organizing across the state, right? They are that, you know, I hate to say it, but they're that, you know, the professional class, right? And that's what they see, right? Because they come out of traditions, you know, they come out of the quants tradition, out of the consultant tradition. They come out of the academic traditions. They don't come out of organizing traditions, right? And those folks that, you know, they held up, you know, the kind of the laborers, right? You know, the unions that they hold up that are going to be part of that. They tend to be a small minority of those folks within the working class in the state. The fact is the Democratic Party has systemically, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the country, has abandoned a class-based politics, right? And there's a long history to that. We can get into that history some other time. I hope to have somebody on the show for that. But that is absolutely the case. And so what we see here, we hear an argument for how the Democrats should be and who matters. Yeah, that's absolutely right. They have less to lose. Let me finish that one sentence. I'm sorry. Or this one paragraph. So some Democrats say Fetterman is too liberal to win a competitive general election, and that the lesson from last year in 2018 midterms elections is that the path to victory runs through the state's populous suburbs, which is such nonsense, where moderate left-of-center candidates with broad appeal can trounce the GOP. U.S. Representative Chrissy Houlihan of Chester County, an Air Force veteran and businesswoman who was first elected in 2018 and is also considering a Senate run, fits that profile. And many Democrats are eager to see State Attorney General Josh Shapiro, a Montgomery County Democrat, who won the most votes of any candidate on the ballot en route to his reelection, to run for governor, as is widely expected. Right? So this is, you know, these are people arguing for their position in the Democratic Party. That's what this is. Right. And this, you know, you notice who we're getting for sources here. Right. We're getting people talking about how progressives are bad. Right. You don't actually get into any counter voices until very, very deep in the article. But let's talk about a little bit what happened in the Lehigh Valley. Let's talk about what happened in the center of the state. Right. There is as much an argument, I would probably even say more of an argument, that the candidates that ran in those districts, right, the candidates they ran in those districts who increased the margins of Democratic votes in those districts, right, helped put Biden over the top. Those candidates may not have won those districts, but the margins mattered hugely. Cumberland County was the perfect example of that. Yes, exactly, Shannon. Right? They said, no, they're never going to win. We're going to abort this. But they built the organizations anyways. You go back and listen to the show with Shana Danielson and Tara Shakespeare we had kind of back in the fall. And we talked about exactly this. We talked about how that is how you invest and you build for winning over the long haul. What these suburban folks want to do is they want to kind of maintain a particular power structure and just to eke out at the margins. If you want to build for the long haul and actually address people's real concerns, you have to build an organization from the ground up. And those folks that ran in those races that decreased the margin of victory for the Republican, right, built organizations that are long lasting and they continue to grow. And now those people are organizers. This is the model going forward, right? But when you've abandoned a huge chunk of the population, when you've abandoned a huge part of the state for such a long time, it takes time relearning who those people are. And guess where you don't learn that from? You don't learn that from some high-rise kind of swanky office in Philadelphia. Or the suburbs of Philadelphia, more like it. You learn it on the ground in those counties, as these candidates have done. So now my blood is definitely boiling. I got this tag now, so I'm going to read the full thing later. But oh my God, that's pretty crazy. Oh God. Anything else on people's minds out there? I'd love to hear what else is going on. I'd love to, you know, I have to say, Lehigh Valley folks, Lehigh Valley DSA up there, I got to say that as you've probably heard me say, if you've tuned into the show before, is I believe that the Lehigh Valley is also carries with it the future of politics in the state. And I could carry that over to kind of what we saw like in Cumberland County and we see in Lancaster. But the Lehigh Valley, where I love the Lehigh Valley. I love living there. I love the people. I love the community. I did not live in those kind of like swanky new high rises that are downtown. Actually, when I went downtown Allentown, not too long ago for some kind of, you know, anti-Trump protest, I couldn't believe the way that looks down there compared to what it was, but whatever. I am so thrilled to see the organizing that's going on in Lehigh Valley. And I should say also, next week on Out to Coop Live, we're going to have Omar Ray. Omar Ray is running for Lehigh County Commissioner out there in Lehigh Valley. He's again yet kind of another progressive, someone else who's kind of has, you know, cut his teeth on some community organizing, has been an activist, looking to end cash bail, looking to extend, you know, healthcare, kind of building on that, building on, you know, the organizing that has been going on in the Lehigh Valley, you know, just as we see, you know, the organizations that, you know, what started out and everybody said that kind of Lancaster, you know, there's going to be no progressive things coming out of Lancaster. And then, whoa, here we go. And now we've got PA stands up a few years down the road, right? I mean, this is a pretty impressive time up here. So pretty cool. Couple of things people want to take out, you know, feel free, anybody want to jump in, everybody want to kind of call in, get other comments, you got things you want to kind of bat around a little bit, I'd love to hear it. A couple of things, I've just reached out to a couple more people to come on the show. There's a new report that is out from the Ohio River Valley Institute. I said that wrong, the Ohio River Valley Institute, which I guess is relatively new. I think they got founded in 2020. There's a new report that came out. It's called Appalachia's Natural Gas Counties, Contributing More to the U.S. Economy and Getting Less in Return. It is a really good read, and this is some really good work, at least from my read of it thus far. Let me give an example from the report. This is on page 3 of the report, and you can get this online. You just go to OhioRiverValleyInstitute.org, and you click on some of the reports. They've got some charts at the beginning, and they talk about what was the impact of things like fracking. And here, for example, is from the report. Between 2008 and 2019, 22 old industrial and rural counties in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, which make up the Appalachian Natural Gas Region, increased their contribution to U.S. gross domestic product by more than one-third. So you're talking about the national gross domestic product, right? So they increased it by more than one-third. In 2008, 22 counties were responsible for $2.46 of every $1,000 of national output. By 2019, the figure had climbed to $3.33. Their rate of GDP growth more than tripled that of the nation. However, during that same period, measures of local economic prosperity, the economic impacts of that growth, not only failed to keep pace with the increased share of the output, they actually declined. Right? If you look at the actual, you know, the charts, that you can see it pretty remarkably. So, when we're looking at GDP, right? And we see that it's just huge amounts of money being made. Why? Because those gas companies are making money. Hand over fist. The extractivists are making tons of cash. Yet the people in those communities are suffering more. This is the story of extractivism right here. So here's some facts. So the 22 county share of the national's personal income fell by 6.3%, right? Let me read that again. The 22 county share of the nation's personal income fell by 6.3%, from $2.62 for every $1,000 to just $2.46 of every $1,000. Their share of jobs fell by 7.6%, from 2.62 in every 1,000 to 2.46. Their share of the nation's population fell by 10.9%, from 3.26 for every 1,000 Americans to 2.9 for every 1,000 Americans. All right? It's a case of economic growth without prosperity, the defining characteristic of the resource curse. Most of the GDP increase in this group of counties was due to the Appalachian natural gas production boom, which was facilitated by the advent of a drilling technique and hydraulic fracking, as we know here in Pennsylvania, right? So the GDP, remember, the national one, it was fueled by that natural gas boom. But Between 2008 and 2019, Appalachia's Marcellus Utica gas fields went from producing a negligible portion of the nation's natural gas to nearly 40%. The growth exceeded even the most optimistic expectations, which were laid out in the 2010 American Petroleum Institute Economic Impact Study. And you remember, what we're always told is that we're always told that this is going to help everybody, right? That's the exchange. Well, we need jobs, so we're going to keep on going on the Marcellus Shale stuff because it's going to help out the communities. And so, no, it's helping out the biggest corporations on the planet that are responsible for destroying our climate. So here's the last part I'll read from this report. The unexpectedly high production should have compounded economic benefits projected by the study, which found that nearly 44,000 new jobs would be created in West Virginia and 212,000 in Pennsylvania. And according to another economic impact study conducted by Kleinhans and Associates, Ohio was supposed to see the creation of an additional 200,000 jobs. At the time they were published, numerous policymakers in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia cited the API and Kleinhans studies, called the coming natural gas production boom a godsend and an economic game changer for a Rust Belt region whose economy had been savaged by the first collapse of the steel industry and then more recently by a sudden declining coal industry. In West Virginia, one state legislator, noting the job creation figure was greater than the state's total number of unemployed, happily proclaimed, "We have more jobs than people." But by 2019, before the onset of the COVID-19 crisis, job creation in Appalachian fracking states was badly lagging that of the nation. Between 2008 and 2019, the number of jobs nationally increased by 10%, but in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia, job growth was less than 4%. Remarkably, despite booming natural gas production, the 22 major gas-producing counties did even worse, with combined job growth of only 1.6%. This extreme disconnect between economic output and local prosperity raises the question of whether Appalachian natural gas industry is capable of generating or even contributing to a broadly shared well-being. And if it is not, should it continue to be the focus of local and regional economic development efforts? My answer to that, of course, is no. So this is a great report. I've also reached out to one of the authors of the report to see if they could come on the show. I'd love to talk to them further about this. And, you know, look, if anybody's got any suggestions of folks that we should have on the show, I'd love to hear it. You can put them in the comments right now. You could drop them in there. Look for stuff on our social media page. We'll have a poll that's going out with kind of suggestions. But if you have any ideas that I would love some ideas from the community about, you know, who we should have on. Because, you know, I've got some, you know, decent contacts across the state. But like I said, you know, you, the listeners, you, the folks who are kind of coming here, part of that progressive community, you're tapped into the local, you know, the local region and might have some ideas about some people that would be great to have on. Maybe they're not getting the big, like, you know, national or statewide attention, right? But are doing really amazing organizing work, right? Those are the kind of people we want to have on the show. Lehigh Demcon once again says, one of our members was on TV about the Allentown teacher who attended January 6th. Oh, that is the other thing that I wanted to bring up. There's a group here. Let me pull out this. Let me see if I can find this. Yeah. So there's a group in the Lehigh Valley, right? Community Research Opposing Hate, right? You can follow them on Twitter at CROHLV. That's CROHLV. And they've been basically doing some really bang up work about some of the folks that attended the January 6th insurrection. And who are kind of have come back home to Pennsylvania. As Sean and I talked about on the show on Friday, Pennsylvania is number two in the nation for the number of people who are arrested for that, for what they did during the insurrection. So a couple examples that you can find here on the Twitter account. Oh, what just happened to my... Here we go. Like, so this one of the tweets that comes out, right, says CRO, the Community Research Opposing Hate, Lehigh Valley, would like to introduce you to Jason Jenkins, disgraced Allentown lawyer who attended the J6 Stop the Steal rally with Allentown middle school teacher Jason Moorhead. Right. So, I mean, you got like middle school teacher and a kind of a lawyer from the Lehigh Valley, kind of both down there for Stop the Steal. And they got the pictures of them right down kind of doing that work. You know, we're finding out that this is not something that took place out there. It took place right down the street from us. Right. Yeah, it happened in DC, but these are folks that, you know, came from our neighborhoods. So shout out to those folks, Community Research Opposing Hate. That's at CROHLV. You can follow them on Twitter. It's very good. The other thing I wanted to give a quick shout out to as well is that there's this great piece. I'm looking forward to this book when it comes out, actually. But this is by Christina Viviana Groger. I think I got her last name, Groger. right. It's called The Education Fix. She's got a book coming out, which it's called The Education Trap, I believe, which focuses, here it is, The Education Trap, Schools and Remaking of Inequality in Boston. But this is an article published in Dissent. I'll try to put these notes in the, or these links in the show notes too as well. Basically talking about this myth about education will set us all free, right? And a little bit about how that's been used historically. And what has been some of the actual tangible income or tangible impacts on a reliance upon that strategy as a strategy for kind of expanding democracy and leveling inequality. you know, spoiler alert, doesn't do what it says it's going to do. So even while she's really kind of careful about acknowledging like how important education is, right? So that's the thing. But in terms of how it has actually been folded into a kind of like an article of faith when it comes to Democratic Party philosophy and ideology, I should be fair about it. So right across the board, really. But education will set you free to a degree, right? There we go. Anyways, there we are, folks. So we're kind of closing out, getting kind of close to closing out the night. But if you have anybody else has any other comments or you want to kind of call in, you know, everything like that, I'd love to hear from you. I really appreciate you kind of coming out and joining for the night. It's been that kind of night. So I don't know. Hopefully everybody's going to stay safe while you're out there too as well, because I know that the freezing rain and snow and all this stuff is coming out. I know kids are going to be home from school once again. But it's like the new kind of snow day, right? The new kind of snow day is, no, kids are still going to have to do their work at home now, right? So they don't really get a snow day, right? So whatever it might be. But I know I'll be doing the same thing, right? So I'll be teaching all my classes tomorrow too, even though Kutztown University is shut down. But kind of is what it is, right? Anyways, anything else for the good of the order out there, folks? Well, I will bid you all then a good evening. Thank you once again for tuning in. And next week, once again, we will have Omar Ray. Omar Ray is a candidate for Lehigh Valley County Commissioner. He has his launch party this week. It is on February 18th at 7 p.m., I believe. At 7 p.m., go check out Omar Ray. Let me see if I can pull up his thing real quick. But it's Omar Ray for Lehigh Valley, or Omar for Lehigh Valley. If you go omarforlehigh.com, that's omarforlehigh.com. You can check out his webpage. You can check out his upcoming events. All his information is right there. Check out his platform and so on. We'll have him on the show next week. So I hope you tune in and kind of hear what he's got to say and see what he hopes to kind of bring to, you know, his candidacy in the Lehigh Valley. So once again, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Got some exciting stuff coming up. If I even get half of the people, half of the people that I put out invites to, if we can actually get half of them to like square with our schedules, finding a time where we both have some time free to do this stuff, we got some cool stuff coming up, and really it's thanks to all you. So what I can ask for everybody out there is, I know a lot of you who are on the show are already kind of patrons of Raging Chicken, like, and I thank you to the bottom of my heart for all the, you know, your continued support, your sharing of kind of what we do. What I would encourage you to do, get a minute or two, make sure you're sharing it with your networks, make sure you're sharing it with your social media contacts. If you haven't already subscribed to our YouTube channel, get on over there and hit that subscribe button. Hit the bell so that you get the notification every time that we go live. You'll get a little notification. And at the as I think I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you know, and again, I recognize, like, you know, my kids watch these YouTubers and I'm like nothing by comparison to this. So we're up to 78 subscribers. I'd love to hit kind of 80 within the next few days. So if you encourage other folks to get out there and kind of like us and subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit that kind of that notification bell. I'd appreciate it. But for now, I bid you all good night. Thank you all for stopping by, spending a little time with us here tonight, and look forward to next week. Look forward to our Friday flagship show with Sean Kitchen, which will be breaking down the good, bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. But for now, I got to start turning and kind of get back to work, I guess, because this was my break for the day. So I wish you all well. Talk to you soon. Keep up the fight. See ya!